want to respond first, though, to the second reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act. Actually, it had created a ... and sexual assault, because they created the National Sexual Violence Resource Center opportunity, and PCAR was successful in winning that cooperative agreement with CDC to create the National Sexual Violence Resource Center. The first VAWA had the Domestic Violence Resource Center, but it wasn't until 5 years later that we got the National Sexual Violence Resource Center. And so I want to talk a little bit about what we've been doing through the NSVRC to build the capacity of the anti-sexual violence movement, understanding and utilization of this research. We've developed a national collaborative of researchers and practitioners. And the goals of that collaborative are, number one, to facilitate networking between different experts, synthesize the information on sexual violence and its prevention, disseminate seminal literature to a wider audience, and explore what is known and unknown about sexual violence and its prevention, and to determine where research needs to be directed. You also need to know that our funding is under the rape prevention education line item, so most of what we do really is focusing on the prevention of sexual violence through the creation of our resource center. We also maintain several other mechanisms that inform the development of research priorities. We do an annual survey with state, territory, and tribal sexual assault coalitions. We maintain a detailed call center database that tracks requests for information and research that we receive, and that we can analyze that on a monthly basis and begin to track trends. We also conduct regular focus groups on emerging issues in the field. So in addition to that, we continue to synthesize and disseminate those research findings through partnerships with researchers, research institutions, and funders of research. And we maintain a comprehensive research collection in our library. So most of you are probably familiar with that if you've been doing this work at all at the www.nsvrc.org, you'll have access to that really comprehensive library. And I think we have over 20,000 items cataloged by, I think the first 5 years of our, we said we'd have 10,000. We have more than doubled that in the last 5 years. But one of the things as I prepared for, before I go into that, I want to talk about, we did identify priorities. So those of you that are researchers that are looking for areas to get funded, let me tell you what has been identified by the field as what they see as priorities. And this was by our studies in 2009. Number one, we want to know the effectiveness and the outcome and the impact of advocacy services for sexual assault victims and their families and friends and partners. Secondly, we need to know what the cost of sexual violence is. What is a comprehensive study that talks about it across the lifespan? I think the domestic violence folks are really good at talking about that, and we don't have enough analysis. There's been some, but no really good research that allows us to talk about that. We also need to talk about the cost effectiveness of our programs, including the SANGs and the SARs. Those are the kinds of things we need to know when we're trying to market our programs and get funding to continue to do this work. We also would like to see updated data on the public perception about sexual violence. We think that has changed since the Violence Against Women Act was passed. We also want data on reporting, investigation, and the prosecution of adult sexual assault. Additionally, we need to know about the effectiveness of the culturally specific outreach programs and the response systems to those traditionally underserved populations. We also know there's data regarding the gap between sexual assault laws and the enforcement of those laws. We'd also like to know what social marketing campaigns have the greatest impact to change public behavior within specific groups, such as young men and in rural communities. And lastly, we'd like to see the further examination of the rates of false versus unfounded reports of rape and sexual assault. When I was working with the Department of Defense, there was this huge misunderstanding. If they said a rape was unfounded, everybody just assumed it was a false report. We need to have more data to help us be able to explain that, particularly to our local communities and our jury pools. So again, as I looked at this, preparing, I decided to look at what has really changed in the last 15 years in the field of services, and certainly this probably isn't a complete list, but certainly the money. I started working in domestic violence shelter in the 80s, and compared to where people were then after the passage of the Violence Against Women Act, the money just increased quadruple, more than quadruple. But what's happening now, we're starting to see that erode. So we had this huge peak, and all these services started to balloon, and actually now we're starting to see the loss of many of the things that we started over the first 15 years with the Violence Against Women Act, and that really is causing me great concern. I had one local director say, I wish we'd never had all that money, because we started promising everybody we could do all these wonderful things, and now we have to keep saying, we're sorry, we can't do that anymore. There's not enough funding to allow us to do that. Secondly, what has changed is certainly the body of knowledge. None of this was, we didn't have access to it. It just wasn't there 15 years ago. I think that it was happening, but what you were doing, I know you were doing it many years ago, but we didn't know about it, for sure. Also, we've always had a really good crisis response, but we really started focusing on primary prevention in the last 15 years. Prior to the Violence Against Women Act, there was very little focus in the field on the prevention of sexual violence. Certainly, technology is huge, a huge impact on what that means to services. Not only do people have readily have access to the information, but it's also making us look at how we provide services. You provide services to a 14-year-old very differently now through technology and what they want through technology versus what those that are my age may have expected. You know, we pick up the phone, call the hotline. The younger generation, they're not going to do that. So those things are changing every day, and we're having actually a very difficult time trying to stay on top of that. So that would be another area of research that I did list. How can we use technology to respond to the future generations when it comes to services? The other thing is the sex offender treatment. Involvement of advocates have become more involved in the treatment of sex offenders. Men are more involved and engaged than they were 15 years ago. And certainly we're now doing evaluation locally. That is just starting. And particularly with services in Pennsylvania, we're just going to start requiring evaluation of services and outcome measurements starting July 1. And we've been working on this. I know when I met you 15 years ago, it was like, we have to do that. It's coming, and it's taken us 15 years to get a tool ready that we can really begin to evaluate qualitatively, do these services work? And which ones work better? What can we do about that? That's a huge step forward, I think, in many of us. It's a little frightening, but we're excited about the fact that we've been really, really beginning to say we're going to evaluate the effectiveness of our direct services. Of course, then we're going to be challenged. Our next step is how do we evaluate and determine the outcomes of our prevention work. That's a huge leap forward, and certainly we're going to need a lot of research. How do we measure these programs? We talk about the data saying that rapes are going down. I'm not sure that we know that. It may be the media has caused more rape victims even more to come forward. We really don't know that. So I think how can we really measure all these new prevention programs we're putting in place now? Do they work? Which ones work? We've got to figure that out. And certainly our field has become more professional. I think a lot of people don't like that, but what does that mean? So how do we maintain that grassroots activism and become more professional? But that is certainly evolving, and most of our programs are becoming more professional, so to speak. And certainly the SANEs and SARCs. Before this, you know, there were less than 6 in Pennsylvania, and those numbers in Pennsylvania quadruple, as you said, they have just grown by leaps and bounds. Leaps and bounds. That didn't come out right. But what hasn't changed, obviously, is the grassroots commitment. It is still there. As I said, we've become more professional, but the grassroots commitment has not changed to providing those basic services. Certainly, we continue to do efforts in the community and about education and awareness, but we still aren't doing skills building. When we're out there doing these programs, we still haven't changed that. The number of programs has remained. Rape crisis centers have not changed. And PCAR is one of the oldest coalitions in the country, and the number of rape crisis centers has changed very little, but now with funding becoming so difficult, we're starting to see a decrease in the number of those centers. And if they don't completely go away, then they merge with the domestic violence programs. So, as I was preparing for this and trying to figure out what kinds of questions to ask, and I look looked at the compendium and I saw this research and certainly noted that most of it's for domestic violence. And I realized after, and particularly in Pennsylvania, we're a rural state. We have 51 centers that cover 67 counties. We're mostly rural. And that information, even though we have the National Resource Center in our backyard, that body of knowledge is not making it to down to small town USA. I think we've learned a little bit. As I said, we've become more professional in our services. We've certainly changed our community education programs. As I said, we're focusing on primary prevention. But even in Pennsylvania, we continue to fund all these different projects. You know, every year we do put out special initiative grants and continue to fund just these spattering of things. We keep making it up as we go. And so we've got all these great things out there, but we've not pulled it together. There's great research. There's great prevention programs. We know some of those are working. We're beginning to have some of these studies that say this really looks like it's a promising practice. So what I want to know, and I would ask my friends here, how can we put that together? That's what I want to do now. Take what we know about what are the best services, whether the cognitive behavior therapy, how can we take that and use it in our local programs, what kinds of prevention programs are working. What I want to do is to identify some model programs, and I said I can tell you there are probably five or six in Pennsylvania, that if I had an overlay of the best of what we know in research, if I could take all of that, services and prevention, and put it in half a dozen communities and really then partner with our researcher friends, let's figure out what works and what doesn't work. We haven't done that, so I'd like for you all to think about how can we take that? We keep talking about that gap between research and practice. How can we do that now? That should be our next step. Let's take what we know. Let's apply it locally. Any thoughts on how we can begin to do that? That's a big question, I know. Well, it's a big science that you talked about.
Oh, I know.
Use the
microphone.
See,
I'm not shocked. I actually pick up the phone and call people, or I go visit people, and I introduce myself, and I say, here's what I'm interested in. Can we collaborate? Is there anything, you know, I can help you with? So I'm a very outreach person. I have found that that helps, as you were suggesting, with the organicness of it. You know, it makes it so that there is a partnership, so that we can talk to each other and work with each other in sort of a very natural way. But sometimes it just takes that one person, either the researcher or the practitioner, just to outreach, to knock on doors, to pick up the phone. I mean, that's always worked for me, and it might not be the only way to go.
I agree with what Mommy said, and to that I would add, I think there's another opportunity for bringing research and practice together, and that's in the way that practitioners are being trained, the way advocates are being trained. In a Midwestern state that I live in that shall remain nameless, I had the opportunity to do an in-depth analysis of the training of service providers in that state. I don't think it's anything particularly surprising or unique, but I was shocked the extent to which rape crisis advocates, law enforcement, and prosecutors were being trained on really dated information. And particularly with your comments about technology, there's been quite a bit of emphasis in developing online training for practitioners. Ending Violence Against Women International has developed some really nice online training resources for advocates, for law enforcement, through prosecutors. We're actually going to do a test in our state of phasing in online training for all practitioners of the sort of idea of, like, let's just start over and let's try to bring evidence-based training into practitioners as a way of bringing the research into the training itself so that when they're being trained from the get-go, part of that training is a synthesis, and it is a summary of what we found in our research to date. So I think that it works both ways, of bringing the research into the training of practitioners and for researchers to do as Bonnie's suggesting, which is to get out and make the contacts ourselves.
And another way I do that, in my victimology class, all the students know that they're going to have to go out and talk with service providers with respect to, you know, what types of services are available locally address different types of victimization. That's always going to be a requirement of my class. So I always make sure that the students, if you will, are ambassadors of knowledge. They take what they learned in the classroom, because one of their assignments is they have to go talk to service providers
last question.
Oh, wow. I only had like 3 pages of questions in. it didn't quite get to how do we do that, take what we know and really replicate it, and understanding that we do have the training. But you know how it costs hundreds of thousands of dollars to develop that online training? And I know in Pennsylvania we're trying to do that. And we also, there are a couple of things that we're concerned about, is that you have to have so much face-to-face time when you're training advocates. So we're trying to find that balance of how much face-to-face time can you have and how much can be online. So that's one of the reasons I think you're not seeing more of that. But I know in Pennsylvania we're getting ready to invest a bunch of money in doing that to really develop that, and certainly it would be available for people to replicate. I guess the other thing then, and I think we've all mentioned this, how can we better serve then? What do we know about research? And when I was looking at the compendium, there's so many different ones that African-American communities, Latino communities, communities with disabilities. So how do we take that body of information and understand what's working well and what's not, and apply it locally? I know many of us are still struggling with how do we do more effective outreach in those communities? What do our services look like? So how can I take what you all know about that or what NIHA has funded and apply that locally as well? In 25 words or less.
25 words or less. Well, I think part of the problem is that what makes it difficult to get that kind of information down to the local level of the practitioners is that we don't have much of it to begin with. The research on the experiences of women of color and other marginalized groups remains a major gap in the compendium. I think it also reflects the underrepresentation of people of color in the academy and those who receive funding. That said, I think it also is a challenge to all of us with white skin to move beyond that and to do research with communities of color. I think there's been some excellent examples. So a recent study funded by NIHA of historically black colleges and universities that involved the research was predominantly Caucasian. They did a fabulous job of understanding the prevalence of sexual assault in them and really worked with their community partners to assess that particular issue in that particular population. So I think it's a challenge on both fronts.